Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here in 2019 with my co-host Laura Chan Baker and Bianca Bramham.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, sandwiched in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the Chamber of Secrets, that is our recording studio, and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping-off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing how to land the job as a creative producer, our industry predictions for 2019, and of course, Mickey Mouse. As we do once a month, we're taking the 3-month slow boat to New York, where we are joined by North American managing agent and producer Bianca Bramham. Bianca, welcome back. Was it a white Christmas? What have we missed since we last spoke almost 3 weeks ago now?
Happy New Year.
HNY.
Guys, something really exciting happened to me over the break.
Tell us more.
Finally yes, made please. It. Some random fashion brand with like 1,000 followers commented on a really old photo of mine on Instagram and reached out to me to ask if I wanted to join their tribe. So,
oh my God.
Guys, 2019, I think it's looking up. New career as a micro influencer. Hell yeah.
You're so late to the game. I know. Seriously. Come on, mate.
Are you in a tribe?
I'm not in a tribe, but I've been asked multiple times.
Are you serious?
I'm cool with the young people, Jeremy.
No, I'm 100% serious. Is this a thing?
This is a thing.
What happens?
Well, either it's like, to join their tribe or to model their products.
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And you've never done it?
No.
Why not?
It's always like weird bikinis that don't fit people who aren't sticks.
Weird bikinis.
Jeremy, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm feeling,
as always,
footloose and fancy free after 20 minutes of IT tech support, getting our stuff working. But no, I'm really excited for the new year. We have so many great things that we're going to be launching. We're excited. This is kind of still the fourth or fifth season of the podcast now.
This is the fifth season. We're halfway through the fifth season.
Jesus, we're in episode 66. Insane.
66. Jeremy, really important before we start, can you please tell our listening audience how good my summer tan is from the holiday break?
I mean, I can't tell anyone because I'm blinded by it, honestly. It's so golden.
It's beautiful.
My whole field, it's like Bird Box over here. It's just like my whole field of vision is just kind of completely. Yeah.
Bianca, can you see it? Can you imagine it? It's beautiful.
I can feel the warmth across the ocean.
Well, let's get things started with a bit of a different link today. This comes from an email from a listener called Emma Dalzell, and really excited that kind of this came through. Again, we love kind of hearing your mail. If you don't know where to reach us, it's podcast@jackiewinter.com. And this is proof that we go and read through everything. And so we're going to open this year and this episode with this email. Laura, why don't you get us started?
Yeah. So a few weeks before the end of 2018, right in the middle of the sort of pre-holiday madness, we received, as you said, Jeremy, this really lovely email from a listener of the show that put a really big smile on all our faces. So first things first, yes, a big shout out to Emma for taking the time to get in touch. You totally made our day. So in amongst the sort of whispers of sweet nothings that we very much enjoyed, thank you, Emma. She also, she let us know about her upcoming move from Melbourne to London. And she asked some pertinent questions about finding work in the production field in a big city like that. And I figured, you know what, this would actually likely be helpful for quite a few people, not just Emma. And what a great opportunity for me to squeeze you guys for all of your brilliant advice. And so with Emma's permission, I've decided to use her email as my link today. And I won't read the email in full because our heads are already big enough, but I'll just jump right to the juicy part. So here's where Emma asks her main questions. She says, I was wondering, with your experience at Jackie Winter, what qualifications and personality traits do you look for when hiring producers? I've had a varied career so far, working as a graphic designer for 8 years, moving into marketing roles in the past 4 years, coordinating advertising campaigns, photo shoots, and working with producers on film shoots. I found it really interesting hearing the stories and different backgrounds of some of the staff at Jackie Winter and how they came to work there. If you have any advice on how to land a super amazing role in an agency like Jackie Winter in a big city like London, I would love to hear it. So, all of this in mind, I have got some questions for us. And B, I want to start with you because you're particularly well positioned to talk about this because, like, A, obviously you're based in a big city, New York, and B, you are currently smack bang in the middle of the hiring process. And, you've also done it multiple times before. So I want to know, what have you been looking for? What set the best applications apart from the others?
Oh, yes. I am smack bang in the middle of the hiring process. And I do have experience. Laura, actually was partly responsible for hiring you. So I'm very proud of that.
You're very good at hiring. What can I say?
I reckon I can distill it down to a few key things. So our work and the role that we do as producers, as creative producers, is kind of unique. So number one, really just having an interest and curiosity for this weird and wonderful thing that we do is super important and something that I'm very much looking for, as is having a curious personality in general. So I'm looking for someone who is fundamentally interested in commercial art, interested in the advertising and creative industry, and really interested in working behind the scenes to support artists and creative projects. And, you know, Emma, it sounds like that sounds like something that you're interested in. So tick box number one. Second, we talk so much on this podcast about how important communication skills are. So having clear and concise communication, both written and verbal, is an absolute must. In our role in production, it is so important to show that you've understood something, you've understood the brief, the problem, the task at hand, and you can communicate in a way that's clear and action-oriented so that everyone involved knows exactly where things are at and what they need to do to keep things forward. But we're also very much looking for someone who's empathetic, someone who's a great listener and is able to adjust their communication style depending on who it is that they're speaking with in order to get the best out of the project. We really are the bridge between everyone, and being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and try and understand what it is that they want, what their needs are, and perhaps where they're coming from is super duper important, especially when working across so many different industries and with so many different personalities, which we do every single day.
Yeah, and I think that must stand not just the specific type of production that we do in commercial art, but any sort of production or project management. Those things that you're pointing out would be absolutely vital.
Yeah, and you know, being able to kind of like step back and look at the big picture and you know, put yourself in someone else's shoes is super important, but also being detail oriented. That is a key skill. You know, a successful producer is really there to ensure that everyone's expectations are met and nothing, you know, along the way of the project gets overlooked. So attention to detail is super important. And finally, it's really about solving problems. So being able to do that is key. We're also in the service industry, so being able to actually tackle problems with curiosity and positivity will really go a long way in ensuring the success of the project and whoever it is that you're working with. So I'd say that they're really kind of what I'm looking for at the core. What about you guys?
Yeah. I think absolutely all the things you've said are really clear in the best producers I've worked with. I can, like, you know, see all those qualities. Jeremy, I want to know, I mean, you've hired many people over the years. Clearly you're great at it as well because you hired Bianca and myself.
I know.
So I want to know, how important are specific qualifications to you guys? Do you require someone to have a certain qualification? Do you think someone should have a certain qualification to work in production? What kind of qualifications do you think actually useful? And how important, you know, regardless of how important it is to you, how important do you think it is to other sort of similar companies? Do people in this industry take qualifications really seriously?
That's a really good question. I mean, and I think that's kind of, it's so interesting. This is coming off the back of this burnout article in BuzzFeed. Have you read this at all?
Oh God, I related so hard to that.
It talks a lot about kind of, you know, the whole kind of educational system and how this kind of, you know, setting people up to kind of do certain things. And it's something very personal for me as well, because yeah, like I never kind of finished my degree. And so I kind of, you know, went back and kind of finished it reluctantly in kind of some ways. But I think production is such a unique role because as far as I'm aware, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but there is no higher education that you can do to become a creative producer. And I think everyone who has been a producer here, like we're a bit of a band of misfits in a way, you know, it's like none of us really kind of, I always kind of talk about how we come from different creative backgrounds. So I don't think specificity in the qualification is important in terms of what it is, but I do think there needs to be some kind of effort shown in terms of training or self-education or something done that is adjacent to that. And I kind of feel that that can take, you know, so many kind of different forms. And I think that's more true the earlier on in the career that you are, because the later on you are, it's really kind of about experience. And at that stage, you never look at what
education. Yeah, who cares degree what someone did 15 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's kind of...
Unless you're hiring a doctor.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Well, yes, as we like to say, it's not brain surgery most of the time. But yeah, I guess there's a few kind of specific things that I kind of look for in production specifically, which is really just kind of making sure that there's either some experience, like, or in and around kind of the arts, and it has to be kind of, this is where it kind of gets a bit sticky as well, because I think the most interesting thing about the work that we do in commercial arts or in the applied arts is that it is on the spectrum between, the spectrum between fine art and commercial art is really wide. And I think if you have to be kind of somewhere in the middle for the kind of work that we do. You know, if someone who has been kind of a studio manager for a fine artist for 10 years or even, you know, 2 years, like can sometimes be great experience, but also it tells me that their expectations have already been kind of set in kind of a certain way that might not kind of prepare them for the kind of commercial realities. And sometimes if they're doing too much kind of commercial experience at that kind of spot, that it might not prepare them for the more, you know, the more kind of demanding and more kind of, advertising. Yeah, this is a kind of real tricky one. And this is kind of where it's kind of something that's like, well, there's a certain X factor where you kind of know it when you see it. But I always kind of look for some kind of experience, especially in kind of volunteer service as well. And this is a personal thing because I did volunteer work and I did kind of lots of internships. That's how I kind of came up. So I think you're always kind of looking for a reflection of yourself kind of in that way. So, but anyone that can show that they are actually kind of interested in kind of being of service kind of in that way, because a production job is very behind the scenes, as you mentioned, Laura, and it's kind of, yeah, it requires kind of knowing or seeing that there's kind of that intrinsic kind of motivation there kind of in some ways. But I think, look, most of the time though, I think when we kind of make a hire, there's already been some kind of groundwork kind of laid in kind of so many ways. And I kind of think, especially in our industry, which is so kind of niche, that doesn't employ kind of a lot of people, when you're in a big city like London, I've always said London is, and the whole EU is, a very difficult place to kind of work in because of the amount of illustrators, the amount of agencies there. There's a lot going on there. So I would think that your chances of getting employed in that market are probably better than they will be in kind of any other place, but it will be kind of more highly competitive. So I do think that there's nothing wrong with, like, I think it's great that so many people just don't kind of email. And I think most other agencies, they want, like, because there's so few people who have production experience or want to kind of do this work. Every time I get an email and says, like, hey, like, you know, I'm really kind of interested in doing this work, I'll always kind of sit down with them, even if there's not kind of a job at that point.
Even if someone knows what production is,
exactly,
or that it's a role and that they're interested in doing it. Because, yeah, exactly. As you said, it's not something that people often are exposed to earlier on in their career until they've worked with a producer. And even once they have, often it probably scares people off doing production, having seen producers work.
Or if I got an email from someone that says they were kind of an account manager somewhere else, or even if they had kind of, you know, something else, I'll typically, you know, sit down with them and kind of talk to them. And sometimes, you know, there's usually not a job at that point, but then you've already kind of laid that foundation. Things kind of will sometimes kind of come together at that stage.
Yeah, B, I totally agree with you as well with the things that you flagged as what you look out for in an application. I want to mention, like, way, way back in episode 1 of this show, as you said, Jeremy, we're at episode 66 today. So
how did you find this little tidbit out?
Well, I remembered that we talked about it and I just looked at the episode outlines. But way back in episode 1, we chatted about what a producer actually does and what makes a great one. So if you're not put off by how novice our recording skills were back then, it might be worth giving that a little listen. But over time, I think I've settled on the number one thing that I would look for in a great producer, obviously in amongst all the things that you mentioned, B, but for me, it's, for want of a better word or a real word, unflappableness. So someone who can be calm and take action even in the midst of a crisis. I think being a great producer, and again, I believe this stands across any type of production or project management, whether that's art or advertising or music, photography, film, architecture, whatever. I think it requires someone who can make quick, creative and clever decisions during what is often chaos. And a great producer, I think, is that sort of can-do fixer kind of person, someone who can move swiftly to sort of creatively solve problems and overcome obstacles. And I think the best producers that I've ever worked with are those that aren't overwhelmed by complications on a project. I think when something goes wrong, they're able to sort of calmly call in whatever backup or solution might be required and keep a level head, and so that the rest of the team can feel confident that the producer has their back and that the producer will be able to do what's needed to protect the various interests of the project, be that the creative vision, the budget, the timeline, etc. That's not easy. I am not unflappable. I am quite flappy. I mean, how you go about showing, you know, that you're unflappable to prospective employers is a tricky question, I guess. I wouldn't advise writing a cover letter about how unflappable you are if you actually aren't. But if that is a key part of your personality, then I think you could make a great producer. And it would be, you know, probably a great idea to show examples of times where you sort of dealt with project challenges in these ways, etc.
Yeah. I mean, and this is exactly, I mean, why we kind of have our, you know, hiring process kind of structured kind of in that way.
I want to know, guys, what are the sort of non-negotiables or deal breakers for you in someone's experience or their actual application?
I have a real particular one that, like, I don't think I've always kind of adhered to, but like the one thing that just kills me is non-follow-ups.
Yeah.
You know, and like I just kind of think it's the easiest thing to do. And it's like, it's in every kind of online article of like how to get a job and everything. And it just kind of, and so much of our job is following up. Mm. You know, it's like that's kind of the first thing kind of you want to see. But I would say, obviously, attention to detail is kind of a big one. You know, kind of like any misspelling of the company name is really hard to
Jackie
kind of come
with
back
a
from.
Y.
Jackie with a Y. Oh, yeah.
No, Bianca, it is Jackie
it
with
is
a Y.
Jackie with a Y. You're fired. but yeah, it's like, you know, not following up can so often be a deal breaker. And sometimes, like, you know, I really need to push people kind of into it somehow just to kind of
well,
do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think that's important for any job you're applying for, but particularly, as you said, with something like production, where so much of our job is about following up and is about sort of trying to sort of generate a response from people. It's like such an easy way to show that you can do that in a polite, professional, friendly way that it's crazy to me that people don't take that up more. But I totally agree. B, following on from what you said at the beginning, biggest deal breaker for me, I mean, like, they have to be able to communicate both in written and verbal forms at a very high level. And I think that encompasses both the obvious things like, you know, solid grasp of grammar, spelling, sentence structure, et cetera. But also, and incredibly importantly, it's that emotional nuance, the clarity, structure of ideas, friendly banter, negotiation skills, and so on. And I really don't think you can be an effective producer without those skills.
Definitely. I also think if I'm like looking at applications, if you want to work with us, your application should show that. You know, you have a
completely
cover, you have
understand
a cover
what
letter.
The company is, what they do, yeah, why you want to be involved. Yeah.
I mean, you have a cover letter, which is a space. I don't know. Some people say cover letters are, they're not necessary anymore or anything like that. But I think that that's the best way to show someone why you want to work with them and why you would be a good fit for whatever reason, even if your skills in your CV or your experience doesn't particularly match with the job. Like, it's a space where you can say, hey, I really understand what you do, like what you do for these reasons. This is who I am. This is why I want to work with you. And this is why I think I would be great. Come sit down
totally.
With me.
So just finally, I want to know, do you guys have any advice for how Emma or anyone else can go about actually landing these sorts of roles? For example, you know, who to contact, how to contact them, where to look for these jobs? Bianca?
Number one, get yourself out there and speak to people. Lara, you and I met in your graduate, at your graduate event, but it wasn't until a year later when we had a role opening at Jackie Winter when you applied. And I remembered sitting down with you at that event and I was like, shit, we need to interview this girl. So personal connections, as Jeremy kind of mentioned at the start, like getting in touch with people, you know, that you're interested in working with when there might not be a position available, or kind of verbalizing some of your goals, or going to community events like Creative Mornings or networking events, joining Slack communities like Ladies Get Paid, or, you know, following interesting people on Twitter. I know there's a friend of mine, Carly Ayers, she retweets job opportunities all of the time. So kind of like being active in the community and not just kind of scouring job sites and maybe making opportunities for yourself is a really good way to go about it.
I think that's a really, really important point there, B. And even not just necessarily networking, but for example, I always think about, like, I actually didn't see the Jackie Winter job ad 5 years ago. It was sent to me from like three different people who just knew that because I had been vocal about wanting to work in a sort of production capacity in the arts, and they were just mates of mine, but they saw it and they thought, oh, this screams of you. This seems great. But if I hadn't have sort of told people about that, and if I hadn't been associating with people in that area and talking about that with them, I probably never would have actually seen the ad and wouldn't have ended up here.
No, really, really good point. I mean, that's the thing. Like, you gotta, it's like the secret, man. Believe and receive. Put it out there that you want to do the work, and you never know what will come on your plate.
You got weird over the holidays, Jeremy.
Yeah, I get weird.
Too much meditation or something.
No, but come on. We have seen that happen countless of times here in freaky ways. It has been
literally happened to me this week. Claire and I sat down and we were talking about, like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if this one artist was working with this one client? And then literally hours later, we got an inquiry for them.
See, it happens. I'll close off with kind of three things that I would kind of suggest directly. I mean, one of them is an extension on what you were saying, be like, you have to kind of put yourself out there. And I think especially for the role that we do, you know, we're kind of agents and managers and producers, all those kind of things. And And a big part about being an agent is going out there and having to meet new people, getting out of your comfort zone. It's not, it's for us, I think different people have different levels of comfort in terms of how much of that they want to be their role, but it is really kind of important to do it. And there are so many kind of different meetups that can happen in real life virtually as well. So I think that's a big part of it in terms of just knowing who the kind of players are kind of in that scene and just kind of, and just making yourself known. And there's really easy ways to do it without it being kind of capital and networking, as long as you're just kind of following your kind of natural interest and have a genuine interest in kind of being part of a community. I think a second thing that I think is really important that I haven't seen a lot of, but I would really encourage people to look at, is really try to collaborate with other visual thinkers, even if that's not your kind of thing, especially if you want to work for an agency like ours or kind of another production company, that whether it's photography, film, whatever, these people usually who will be very literate visually kind of in that way. And one thing, I mean, because of my background as the designer, anytime I see a CV that has obviously been designed or had some designed attention put into it, it's always kind of just kind of goes to the top of my mind. And it shows me that they can kind of get people kind of together. Usually if that person, like I can tell by that person that they're not a graphic designer or they're not kind of a filmmaker or kind of anything like that, but they either their partner was or their friend was, or they went and found someone who helped them with kind of their CV. And that just kind of shows me that, like, okay, part of their life is kind of bringing people together. And that's kind of a really interesting skill that I see.
I love the idea of collaborating with someone for them to help design your CV.
Yeah, I've seen it happen numerous times, not only kind of help them design it, but sometimes, you know, even kind of help them write it or kind of how they kind of package themselves together. I've seen some very elaborate CV packages. I'm not saying that it has to be kind of a novelty or anything like that.
I would want someone to help them write it, because that's such an example of their writing. And if I hired them and then they were not very good at it.
Oh, well, all that stuff kind of happens in other things. And that's why I think it's really important for a good interview process to make sure that all those forms of communications are kind of rounded out. That's why we do phone screens and make sure we have things in writing and in email and other stuff. And then the last thing that I would kind of say is that just because there aren't those formal educational pathways, is kind of just going back to the initial question, doesn't mean that there aren't educational opportunities out there. I'm seeing lots more and more kind of short courses, both online, like, you know, things like General Assembly, for example. Like, you know, someone who's interested in production, there's no reason you couldn't kind of do a short course in Scrum or Agile or something else to give you those skills, even if they're in a different industry, that you can kind of apply. Or if it's a self-directed course that you did, or even kind of something, you know, that it's kind of like books that you read and kind of what you kind of learned.
Actually, on that note, one thing that we often, for some reason we haven't mentioned here, but something we often talk about is how, as a producer, it's, you need to understand the technologies and the processes that you'll be working with. So it's not necessarily just taking courses in production, but learning about, I don't know, how animation works if you want to be an animation producer, or working about
Absolutely.
How painters work, how modelers work, how whatever music production works, and understanding the jargon that's involved in those, all the various terms, what the different specs mean, all of that stuff is really, really vital.
And professional societies are still a great option. So, you know, being a member of the AOI, being a member of SPD, if you're into editorial design, being a member of Young Guns,
the IGA, One Club,
yeah, all those kind of things. You know, they, like, I know over here, like the Ad Council, for example, they do account management courses kind of once a year as well. And I've seen them kind of happen around the place. So look, the options are there. It's hard, but it's not impossible. And, you know, it just requires the right effort and motivation. So I think we'll end it there. Emma and everyone else, I hope you found that really helpful. Laura, thanks for fielding that and getting that to us this week. And I think we'll move on from there. Next up, it's me. And as always, November and December are stacked with best of lists from an ever-increasing number of sources. Are you into the best of lists at all? Is there a particular one that you like?
I avoided most of them. I like some of the best of book lists. I like that. And then I sort of, because I tend to get a big batch of books at the start of the year and sort of like close myself off in my room and read them for the first few months of the year.
Playlist ones are really big for me. Like, I love now that, like, you know, with shared playlists, like, you know, for example, there's the Slate Summer Strut one that happens.
Oh, love Summer Strut.
Yeah, there's the
Slow Down Slow Jams.
So good.
Yeah, all like, you know, Pitchfork's top 50 albums. The pop cultures.
Yeah, we're very cool.
Well,
yeah.
Look, I'm still working through my own personal favorites. It's the AV Club. They do a series of best ofs at the end of the year that is fantastic. And look, our own industry of advertising design is not immune to these lists. And around this time last year, we did our own take on it. We did our own kind of best ofs. However, this year, I thought we'd take a bit of a different approach. And so I'm going to take a leaf out of the page of one of my favorite podcasts, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, for the past few years, they've done these pop culture resolutions and predictions episodes. And my favorite part, listening to the show for kind of so long and like developing my knowledge of kind of the host and kind of what their, you know, various kind of quirks are, is that they actually replay their predictions from the previous year and then they kind of evaluate them the next year, which is,
holy moly.
It's also amazing to feel how quickly the year goes because these episodes are very fresh. But
like, a year's a long time, but also not a lot happens in a year.
No, it's crazy. To that end, this is about links, and I was also inspired by a recent post from Australian Ad News, which is an online and print publication, and they did a pretty impressive job asking over 20 of the country's leading ad agencies for their own predictions, and there are some pretty interesting ones in the bag.
We talked about the 2018 predictions as well on the podcast.
Did we really?
Some point, some time ago, yeah.
Well, look, I'll come back to that, but look, there are around 20 people there, mostly representing ad agencies. It was interesting that there weren't a lot of consultancies or kind of design studios or anything there, but my personal favorite comes, as always, from Team Thinkerbell, who can always be counted on for a good quote, and their prediction was, "We predict prediction columns will start to eat themselves. There will be an increasing number of irrelevant answers in this column as more and more people become disillusioned with their ability to predict what's happening for dinner, let alone next year." And look, I gotta say, after reading all the predictions in this list, I can't help but feel the same thing was repeated in so many ways. There were no real kind of new ideas or kind of any real kind of vigorous thinking from the industry that is supposed to be providing them, which was really frustrating and alarming in some ways, if, like, you know, the actual industry that's supposed to be the most creative and innovative isn't kind of putting those things forward.
I do want to point out Thinkerbell's prediction from 2018.
What was that?
Which was, "I predict that in 2018, fax machines will make a comeback."
Can we have a laugh about that one?
That was good. So look, I want to try to fill some of the gaps here. So B, Lara, what did you make of these kind of predictions, thoughts, this piece? And I want to get like kind of your own industry prediction for 2019, and I'll round off with my same.
Yeah, before we get into our actual predictions, I wanted to just, at the start of this ad news piece, they talk about obviously the sort of how everyone was freaking out about the threat of consultancies this year and how sort of 12 months later, that perceived threat has dimmed a little bit and people have sort of started to adapt to this new world order. There was always, you know, people would talk about how, about like doing a Howcroft, Russell Howcroft, when he moved to PwC after his very long career in advertising. People talk about doing a Howcroft, people jumping from advertising to consultancies. And now they're talking about maybe things are sort of starting to reverse because people are going from PwC, like Nikki Bryson from PwC returned to TBWA Sydney, Sunita Gloucester exited PwC for WPP, and how it might become doing a Gloucester. And I like how those terms might reverse year on, year off.
Laura, what about your own personal prediction for 2019? Do you have anything?
Yeah, I agree with you. I kind of hate these lists. They're never specific enough. Every year,
it's like, you know, the big idea will be championed. Creativity will be championed.
Every year, every ad person says something about creativity being key and how all agencies just need to focus on being creative. And I'm like, well, just fucking go do it then. Like,
I loved Chris from Cummins and Partners, the CEO. His was huge opportunities will continue to exist for brands and agencies alike, just like every other year. WPP will be acquired by KPMG and then merge with PwC to form WPP, KPMG, PwC. Sheryl Sandberg will resign and move to Tesla. Elon Musk will move to Mars. Mars will continue to help you work, rest, and play. And a champion will rise to lead the resurrection of advertising as a key driver of growth.
I remember Chris had a good one last year as well. So good work, Chris. I can't believe that there weren't any comments on this article. I think that's definitely the part I was most looking forward to. If this had been on Mumbrella or Campaign Brief,
there would surely
be a ton of snide comments for us to loll over. So how disappointing. But yes, you know, they all sort of, as we said, talk about their sort of creativity. However, I do think that now finally some of the immediate freakouts about AI and social media and programmatic advertising and the consultancies and whatever else have sort of finally started to die down. And people are realizing that things are at the core the same as they always were. So hopefully we will maybe see a return to some of the more creative and sort of long-term brand building work that I do think has always driven the most successful returns. And now I sound like every other one of them. As one person put it, I believe it was David Fox, who's WPP's chief transformation officer, whatever that is. He said, "The creative agencies that understand that brand is the unifier, not technology, will continue to be relevant in 2019 and beyond." And I know lots of people said similar things, but I think it's true. Anyway, my predictions. I have several. First, some commercial art focused predictions for 2019. I think in the same standard fashion of the commercial world being about a year behind everything else in terms of trends, I predict that we're going to see a lot of highly contrasting neon color palettes, lots of dreamy abstract 3D work, and also lots of inspiration taken from classical, like 18th century art styles and compositions. Those are my art predictions for this year. And then another prediction is one that has sort of been everyone's prediction for the last 3 years, and that's the increase of activity and uptake in the AR, VR, and AI spaces. And I know that that's a tired, boring old prediction, but the reason I'm much more excited about it now than previously is the sort of much anticipated rollout of 5G around the world and finally happening in Australia as well. 5G opens up all the opportunities for seamless augmented reality and virtual reality that the creative industry needs to really make use of them. And of course, you know, we have to wait for 5G capable devices to be available and widespread. So it's going to take time. It's probably more of a 2 to 3 year prediction. But I do strongly believe that it's the tech that's going to make all the other new tech that we're always talking about actually happen. And it's going to probably kick off this year, which is exciting. I mean, AR, VI, AI, Internet of Things, driverless cars, etc., they all need crazy data speeds to actually function on a public network. And 5G is seriously fast. And more importantly, it has way lower latency, which is basically the time it takes for information to sort of get from your device to the wider internet and back again. And currently in Australia, the typical latency for a 4G network is around 60 milliseconds, but 5G could bring this down to as low as 1 millisecond. I know that difference might seem unnecessary because like 60 milliseconds is pretty quick, but this decrease is really critical for tech like autonomous cars and things like that, that things that have to make near instant decisions every time something happens on the road. And latency speeds have been one of the key things preventing AR and VR from reaching their full potential. So removing this is one less barrier to making these things more consumable and adoptable. And I think we're really going to start to see that shift properly this year. And undoubtedly, I'd add that, you know, the higher speeds are going to affect far more than just mobile and desktop screens. I think we're probably entering a kind of post-smartphone era where other sort of internet-connected devices and wearables become as or even more important than the phone. Speeds like this also really allow advertisers to personalize messaging to any device or screen, no matter the time or place. With, you know, outdoor advertising, for example, you'll be able to actually interact with and react to passersby in a totally new way, talking to people in real time. And whatever you think of the benefits or lack of benefits of that in terms of sort of actual brand building, it's going to be possible and people are going to be doing it. And of course, it's impossible to predict what the widespread rollout of 5G might, you know, precede. Like when 4G was being built, we didn't know that it was going to be that extra bandwidth that was needed to sort of power huge shifts like Uber, Airbnb, other sort of sharing economy apps, Apple Watches, the explosion of mobile as everyone's primary screen, and so on. So yeah, who knows what 5G will usher in. As I said, it's probably more of a 2 to 3 year prediction, but I'm so excited to see it kick off. Broad implementation won't happen for a few more years probably, but advertisers would probably be wise to start thinking now about how faster networks and device connectivity will benefit future campaigns.
That's a mouthful.
I am excited about this stuff.
I can tell.
I do have personal predictions for each of you. Do you want to hear them?
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My first prediction is that by this time next year, Bianca Bramham will be engaged. That's my first one.
Oh, shit.
Oh, shit. And for Jeremy, I predict that by this time next year, you A, will still have a mustache, and B, will have a full VR setup, not just in the office, but in your home.
I think it'll okay, be like embedded into your brain.
These are very interesting. What about you now? What's your prediction? Do you have any resolutions for yourself?
I'm just going to keep kicking goals, mate. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll have at least 7 more dogs.
Can you match this incredible foresight at all with your predictions for the new year?
Let me look into my crystal ball. Did you guys read that New York Mag Intelligencer article I posted to our professional development Slack the other week?
No.
Maybe. It was called How Much of the Internet is Fake? Turns out a lot of it actually. Mm. No. Mm. Anyway, I'll post a link to it in our show notes so you can read it later, but it was a pretty sobering read about everything that I think that we all know about the state of the internet, especially relating to advertising and metrics. And what I'll also post is a Twitter thread in response to the article from the director of ad tech at the Washington Post, which I quite enjoyed, which dives into a lot of this in more detail, which kind of fuels a little bit of my prediction. Can we swear on this podcast? Yes.
I mean, I just did.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to read you Aram's first tweet that kicks off his thread. The numbers are all fucking fake. The metrics are bullshit. The agencies responsible for enforcing good practices are knowing bullshitters, enforcing and profiting off all the fake numbers. And none of the models make sense at scale or actual human users. So my prediction, which is kind of more of my wish for 2019, is that the industry learns from its mistakes, that we learn from things like the Department of Justice investigation into media buying, the great Facebook video metrics cover-up of 2018, or the, oops, we're Instagram and we accidentally thought that you would want to tap through your feed horizontally instead of scrolling. Did any of you get that update?
Well, no.
Oh my God.
I just hope that we learn from it and, you know, maybe take a step back and go back to basics and, you know, put ourselves in the customer or the audience's shoes for a moment. And like, I don't know, this is a bit like utopian.
That's an interesting point. Putting yourself in the customer's shoes, like harking back to what Jana was saying when we had Jana Perkovic on the podcast the other day, I agree with her that we're going to start seeing some interesting battles between, for example, like retailers and lawmakers and the public, because on the one hand, putting yourself into customer's shoes means giving them the best possible experience. And often that means using these data in ways that on paper, if you actually read through it, you wouldn't be okay with. But when you have that experience, often people are really eager to sort of to have that. And there'll probably be these battles between retailers and lawmakers as people are sort of companies are eager to sort of use all these crazy masses of data and technology to create entirely new, exciting experiences. But also as people really, truly for the first time, as we've seen over the last like 2 years, reckon with what this actually means for you as a human being and for us as a society.
Yeah. I mean, I would kind of say that thinking empathetically about who the audience is perhaps to actually take a step back and not do that. But I don't know. That's a big
completely. Problem. I agree. That's the thing, is that thinking about who the audience is can mean both things.
Yeah. And it's, oh, definitely. Definitely. But yeah. Bottom line for me is that advertising, especially on the internet, is broken. And I really do hope that brands and advertisers who value, you know, good quality content and a clear message will still cut through in 2019 amongst all of this bullshit. But to be a little bit more specific, on a personal note, Amazon and Google are both setting up headquarters here in New York. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to afford to even live in this city anymore. I have no clue.
So you say you don't know if you'll be working for Jackie Winter anymore. Shit, what a way to announce it. Well, later, Jeremy.
I don't know. Like, I mean, like, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to be able to afford to live here. Like, we're like Silicon Valley 2.0. But really, speaking of tech giants like Amazon, Apple, and even Google, I think that streaming services will continue to boom in 2019. And these companies will continue to invest a lot in creating original content for their own platforms, whether that's editorial or entertainment. I did actually see someone today from like the Google design department was looking for an art director with experience in editorial. So I'm like, what does that mean? Don't know.
Love it. Jeremy, before you tell us your predictions, I want to ask you a specific Apple prediction.
Yes.
Do you think that in the year to come, they will continue to raise prices or actually release something new finally?
Ooh. Contentious.
There's a lot of talk about at the moment about how repairs to iPhones are actually hurting their bottom line.
I mean, look, there's so many kind of Apple think pieces around. I don't know. Like that's trying to predict what they're going to do, I think is a serious business in itself. Mm. You know, that's where everyone's trying to, you know, speculate kind of on their stock and how it's going to affect it. And yeah, that's why, you know, there's such a kind of top secret, you know, company kind of in that regard. My personal feeling is, I mean, I really don't know. I kind of think that definitely something is going to be, I kind of feel, it was so interesting. When the iPhone came out, everyone kind of knew it was kind of going in that direction. You know, I don't know if you guys remember, they had the Motorola Rocker phone, like, which was supposed to be like, you know, the Apple phone that's
well, and there was the iPod
announced.
Touch.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
which
yeah,
there was pointed everything in that. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, like right now, it's
still
like
revolutionary.
Well, the only thing that I think people are talking about right now is like, okay, Apple's going to come out with a car, or it's going to be like a TV or kind of something else. Like, I can't really think of any other thing that would happen. And those things are just so big.
They're robot gonna have to, vacuum.
Robot vacuum, robot hair curler, any of those things. I mean, they're going to have to be so far in the future. But look, that's...
Jeremy, give us your predictions.
My prediction is no, it's not going to happen in the next year. Nothing big.
Your other predictions.
Oh, my other predictions. Sorry. My predictions is pretty kind of minor or kind of smaller compared to you guys. And I think this is, I don't want to kind of, you know, be guilty of this, of the same thing that a lot of these people in this link were coming from, but I kind of think.
Especially after in your notes to us telling us we had to be specific.
Yes. Anyway.
Some serious peddling happening.
No. Let me get into it. My prediction really relates around kind of the in-house model on how I think companies are really trying to bring more things in-house. And this really comes back to Apple kind of a lot of ways. especially to things I've read about Jony Ive in terms of what he's kind of tried to do in terms of set up their own in-house kind of creative teams and how Apple's kind of developing their own creative teams, which is where, you know, the whole idea of the new Apple Park campus, for example, is getting everyone kind of together kind of in one space so they don't have to kind of work with kind of external vendors. And they're kind of this, they're just making this kind of creative playground because they obviously have so much money, but the fact that they can get a filmmaker sitting next to a typographer, next to a graphic designer, next to kind of a software engineer and getting everyone to kind of work together in this kind of one physical place. And I kind of see that there's a few interesting kind of convergences happening. I think one of them, especially within co-working spaces as well, like, you know, getting these big spaces where lots of kind of disparate people are kind of coming together, but, you know, still working in isolation kind of some ways. And I'm also kind of noticing this thing happening where, especially with our clients, that they're kind of coming in-house now and brands are contacting us directly, not kind of through their agencies. It's going through a bit of a painful process at the moment, like where especially a lot of the kind of bigger infrastructure that brands used to work with, whether it comes to things like RFPs, for example, or kind of like, you know, not engaging vendors more kind of as partners in these kind of bigger relationships. The whole kind of way that creatives are kind of being, especially smaller creatives are being kind of engaged, I kind of think is changing. So what I'm kind of seeing is, I think people have tried to do this model in a lot of ways. Like, I think one company we've spoken about before, Superfriends, is a great example about that. Like, you know, kind of, they kind of function as this kind of little ad hoc agency where there's kind of, there's someone at the top putting it all together. And then like these kind of super friends that they have that kind of, you know, assemble depending kind of on the brief. And I think we're going to be seeing kind of a lot more of this and these micro agencies kind of forming through the needs of companies changing and through the infrastructure of these kind of co-working spaces happening. But, you know, and from a specific point, this is where I'm a bit bummed out because there's an app that's being developed by someone in Australia. I think it's like a father and daughter team. And if anyone can remember what it is, I would love to know because I totally bloody forgot. And like they are setting up this really cool app that kind of is kind of going to automate this kind of process a bit more, like to allow these kind of agile kind of rollouts of these kind of micro kind of representation agencies or micro agencies. So my solid prediction is that, and I hope they kind of achieve great success, but I think we'll start to see more of businesses like Superfriends that are going to be more adaptable kind of in this way as the kind of freelance economy kind of continues growing. And my last prediction is that, I mean, Jackie Winter will do release two new things in the next kind of 4 months. It will blow everyone's minds.
That's cheating, but I agree.
So yeah, no, we're hoping for that as well. So, oh God, I also predict that this segment will end right now because we've been going on for too long. So thank you, everyone. We'll try to replay these next year, see how we did and move on from there. Our final link of the week, B, take us down with something nice and easy, a bit of a Mickey Mouse and a public domain chat.
Yes, this is from a website called Ars Technica, and I bet you both weren't spending your New Year's Eve thinking about copyright, were you?
No, I was at home. Sorry about copyright.
I always am.
So when the clock ticked over into 2019, all copyrighted works published in 1923, with a few exceptions, fell into the public domain. 1923, why is that year significant? Well, I'll take you on a little bit of a history lesson before we get into it.
That's my hand harp music.
Back in 1998, anything published in 1923 was scheduled to expire at the beginning of 1999. However, in 1998, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act was passed in Congress. This added another 20 years to the terms of older works, keeping these works from 1923 locked up until 2019. Most copyrighted works, though, I mean, they don't really maintain any commercial value beyond, say, a decade or two. But back in 98, a small minority of famous works from the 1920s and 30s were still generating significant revenues, which led to resistance from parties like Disney, the Gershwin Family Trust, and the grandchildren of Oscar Hammerstein, who pushed very hard, as I'm sure you can understand why, to extend the copyright term and ultimately won. So that is your history lesson.
And we talked actually about this before on the podcast. I'll need to get the link where we were talking about the copyright changes being proposed in Australia.
We did.
Which was kind of similar.
Yeah. I mean, this is a US article. I'm paraphrasing a lot of this from this article posted on Ars Technica, which is titled, Mickey Mouse Will Be Public Domain Soon. Here's What That Means. So until recently, the author assumed that the same interest groups who led the resistance back in 1998 would try to extend copyright terms again in 2018. Over the last 20 years, though, the political climate for copyright legislation has changed radically. And I'm sure we talked a lot about that when we did talk about how it was shifting in Australia. I mean, Jeremy, I'm sure you're more familiar than I am with the Stop Online Piracy Act.
He's making a face that is very
confident. Never heard about it before?
No.
Oh, okay. Anyway. Last year, the same publication reported that three of America's most powerful rights holder groups, the Motion Picture Association of America, the Recording Industry Association of America, and the Authors Guild, were not even going to try to pass legislation extending copyrights. So without an extension in place, this means that on January 1st, 2024, the copyright for Disney's Steamboat Willie will expire. And with it, the claim to the film star, possibly the most iconic character in the world, Mickey Mouse, will fall into the public domain. So obviously, retroactively extending copyright terms back in 99 resulted in huge payouts for these companies and the families that own the rights to these works. So why the hell would they not fight back? Huge question. I mean, considering the rise of the internet and its remix culture and what's likely to be very heavy pushback by some big tech giants with very deep pockets like Google, as well as very well organized grassroots campaigns from organizations like Reddit and Wikipedia, they simply do not think that they will win. So I'm a little bit conflicted about what all this means, but it kind of seems significant, especially in our work as trying to protect an artist's right to their own work. The article goes on to talk about the legal minefield that using public domain characters could become, as well as the added complication of trademark law, but I wanted to really just focus on the idea of copyright itself. So looking into the future, you guys, it's the theme of the episode.
Indeed.
Do you think copyright as we know it will still exist?
Yes. End of episode.
That is too easy. Yeah, I mean, God, this whole thing is so interesting. I actually had no idea about this enormous gap in time between sort of American copyrighted artifacts being released into the public domain. It's like, when you think about it, it's essentially been frozen in time for 20 years, and we're just now reaching this thawing period. And it's fascinating when you realize that never have we had such a mass entry into the public domain in the digital age, because the last one in 1998, that predated Google, right? So the potential impact on culture and creativity is huge. And from here on out, every year on Jan 1st, there will be a whole bunch of, you know, long overlooked or sought after works released for public use, stuff from the Great Depression, from World War II, et cetera. It's just, I don't know, it's kind of crazy to think about these sort of time capsules that we're going to be able to crack open now on a yearly basis, don't you think?
I mean, yeah.
You're more cynical than I am.
No.
I mean, as always.
It's interesting. I can't believe how, you know, fast kind of time has gone. And this was a really kind of interesting piece. Also, in terms of one of the biggest things that I kind of took away that I really consider is that this is only an expiration of the original kind of Mickey.
Yes.
That is not wearing the kind of white gloves, and the new Mickey that has the white gloves and is kind of much more kind of 3D kind of is still protected. I don't know. I think the old Mickey is actually much more on trend right now. So you could probably exploit that
in
a much kind of bigger way. But it doesn't seem to me that, like, it seems to me that they're pretty switched on to like the commercial realities of the situation. It doesn't feel like the reasoning of kind of remakes and internet culture is actually kind of real or kind of relevant.
Well, yeah, they did talk about how, you know, obviously the thing that he sort of mentions in the article is that, like, they hold both copyright and trademark protections for the Mickey Mouse character. So although copyright protection expires, trademark actually doesn't. So even after all significant Mickey Mouse copyrights have expired sometime long in the future, Disney could potentially use trademark law as a weapon against these sort of unauthorized Mickey Mouse products. But that said, like, others, such as 20th Century Fox, have tried to use trademark law arguments to restrict republication of creative works, and that's been rejected by the Supreme Court. And that sort of sets a bit of a precedent for the notion that you can't use trademark law to control the distribution of a previously copyrighted work. Like, the High Court sort of made all these statements about how they specifically don't want trademark law to be used, yet prohibit the release of things that had been previously covered by copyright protection. I mean, who knows? Even so, as is, like, litigation on that basis is inevitable. So it's going to be interesting to see it all play out. And obviously, yeah, no doubt, I don't think amongst anyone that just because they're not fighting the ruling doesn't mean they won't actually fight cases of actual use of the Mickey character.
Look, absolutely. I mean, I kind of think the general direction that things are going in is increased kind of knowledge about ownership kind of things. And I think the fight to, we talk about this all the time in terms of when we talk about government policy, it's so much easier to it's easy to give things to people and it's hard to kind of take those things away. Like, I think the whole idea of taking copyright protection away in any way, shape or form is going to be a very expensive and long fight that, in terms of all the other kind of pressing political matters that need to be addressed, it seems to me to be on, shouldn't kind of have precedent right now.
But you don't agree that at some point copyright protection should come to an end? At some point things should belong to the public domain?
Well, that's the current law though. And yeah, like, yeah. And I kind of, that's a good question. I haven't really kind of fully kind of grappled with that, but I do think the idea of kind of ownership is kind of changing with the sharing economy in one
Completely.
Way, but even something like kind of Bitcoin or crypto, where the whole idea of that is proving ownership and kind of getting ownership. And if anything, ownership in those kind of things is much more, like, you have to have that physical object or kind of access to that key, and how you kind of have those things is kind of very strange. And also because copyright is a global thing as well, depending kind of where the work is created, it's going to be a different thing for people who are creating work and, you know, for a very mobile workforce.
Well, see, I was trying to figure out
making work from,
because it was baffling my brain a bit about whether the law applies because you're in a particular country or because the work was created in a particular country. And it's very confusing because it changes everywhere. And there are international laws. There's some like Berne's agreement or something that says that like it's covered by the law of the country you're actually in.
Yeah, that's where we're going to set up an artist colony, like an international waters. There's only going to be
Aruba.
Some
of this stuff that's entered the public domain is still actually not available for public use in some countries because their laws don't. Anyway, it's pretty interesting. I have no idea how copyright will change in the future. I think there are a lot of different minds battling that same question at the moment and have been for a long time now, and it's probably only going to get stronger. I think you sort of dismissed it, but you know, they do talk in the article that, you know, about how the rise of the internet, its remix culture, means that a lot of people now benefit from a growing public domain in ways that weren't really true in 1998. I think back then it meant obviously an enormous amount to the copyright holders to retain it because they make so much money off it, just the same as they, you know, they do now. But the ability to use these works wasn't necessarily of as much use to the public or as much danger to the companies. Like, if some random person put on a play somewhere, whatever, it doesn't really, there's not the same possibilities for someone to mass market some product, you know? And, you know, obviously, Bianca, you talked about how now there would be these hugely sort of organized and well-funded companies like Google, Wikipedia, et cetera, fighting against any kind of push for an extension. But I do think, like, it's interesting to consider how copyright law will have to be adjusted to account for the changing way in which we use both our own and other people's IP. And to that end, like, I don't even know how I want it to change because, like, admittedly, I have conflicting interests. Like, on the one hand, I believe wholeheartedly in the right of a creator to have ownership over their work. And then on the other hand, as a person of the public who, A, wants access to these things, and B, is really excited to buy lots of sort of new technologies, there are many services that I use and want to use that really benefit from the free use of works, and not just of works, I'm just talking about like art or film, but data, like information of all sorts. And it's incredibly tricky because my thoughts on copyright change on a very case-by-case basis, which is not how the law can work. And I mean, like, of course laws are complex and they're layered, but at some point there has to be some blanket ruling that covers a range of situations. And that's what makes any question about legal specificity and practice extremely multifaceted and difficult. And I think writing laws must be one of the hardest conflicting brain-busting jobs in the world. I don't know how people do it.
It's one of those things with copyright where it's like the law is there to kind of set the guidelines and it doesn't really kind of get defended until, or kind of established until, it kind of goes to court. And again, all in all, just another great case for licensing. Don't give your copyright away. Manage the use of kind of your work and the kind of the things you're creating, and shouldn't be a problem.
I just wanted to note as well that the duration of copyright under Australian law was extended in 2005. So it was originally life of the creator plus 50 years, and it was extended to life of the creator plus 70 years. And the changes weren't retrospective. So any works already out of copyright or that were due to come out that year remained in or entered into the public domain. But because of this extension to 70 years, no published Australian works will actually come out of copyright and into the public domain until January 1st, 2025.
Sick. I know what I'm doing.
Guys, my intention this week was just to bring you a fluff piece, but I think I have like opened up an existential
Pandora's box. No fluff piece that we can't.
Can't tease that. We're just natural bullshitters. Okay. Well, look, B, thank you for bringing us the fluff as always. And I think that'll do us for this week. Before we wrap up, it is time for sweaty drumroll, please. Thumbs up, thumbs down, shaka. The time we dedicate each week to get the good, bad, and the completely groovy off our chest. Lara, what do you got?
Mine is groovy.
You got a shaka.
I got a shucker for sure. My shucker is for Salad Beer, which is the name that our household has affectionately given to Big Head Beer, which is from Burley Brewery, brewed just up in Burley Heads in Queensland, where I was over the Christmas holidays. I have always scoffed. I have laughed at zero carb beer, but this is grouse. It's zero carbs. It's 88 calories per bottle. It's full flavor and full strength. It's fucking ace. Big Head
Beer. Is it part of your influencer tribe? Have you been influenced?
Sponsored cars, hashtag ad.
Yeah, exactly.
Shit, if Big Head Beer want to sponsor me, that would be great because I've been spending a fortune on it at the local bottler. So
hashtag ad.
Get on it.
B, what do you got?
I just want, I mean, my thumbs down. I didn't really have one, but my thumbs down on that note is the worst thing about living in New York is that the beer here is all like floral and hoppy IPA. That's kind of like the beer of the moment.
Yeah, they love IPA.
For like years, it's just taken me so long to figure out like what kind of beer I like and I wanted to order. And then I finally realized it's just a beer flavored beer, a lager, but it's kind of hard to come by.
It's funny in Australia, every company is getting around the session ale. I think what every single beer company. It's a beer that you can drink for a whole session.
What the fuck is a session?
Sesh.
Like a Sunday sesh.
Like a beer that you can drink multiples of, you know, like a Sunday sesh.
Isn't
exactly.
That all beer?
But every brand, yeah, is releasing like what they're calling a session now, which just means like easy drinking beer. But it can be any beer. So it doesn't make any sense. But I still like a session.
I wonder if that's kind of just like a bud, like a, or like a Tecate or a something that just, it doesn't, it just kind of tastes like water.
Oh my God. B, was that your thumbs up?
Yeah, that was my thumbs down.
Thumbs down. Jeremy, what about you?
I got a shaka, so I want to make sure we round it out every week. But yeah, my shaka is for the Sapphire Coast of New South Wales, where I went on holiday and had an amazing time. And I think the trick to finding a good holiday place or anything is like, it has to be far enough away that it's kind of a semi pain to kind of get to, but close enough that it's still kind of reasonable. And this is kind of like halfway between both Sydney and Melbourne. So kind of like a 7-hour drive kind of both ways. And it's just like, I don't know. It's just, it's a,
cause that means it's not packed, but
exactly.
There's stuff there.
It was absolutely amazing. So like, you know, as much as I don't want to kind of let the secret out, like it's such an amazing,
what was the name of the place you went to?
I don't want to, you know, get into too much detail, but just the general kind of Sapphire Coast.
Someone PayPal me $5 and I'll tell you.
It's fantastic. I highly recommend a deep shock.
Laura, is your New Year's resolution just to be a hustler?
Hell yeah.
You are hustling. I'm noticing a bit of extra hustle. Okay, that'll do us for this week. Thanks so much, Laura, and thank you,
Thanks.
B. Stay warm and stay cool. I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Laura Chan-Baker. She's Bianca Bramham. And this has been JWGYTB. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. Check out his stuff at soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more of the podcast, archives of all of our shows can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive all the links we talk about in the show each week in one neat little package, along with all the other Jackie Winter news from the week, you can sign up to our brand new newsletter. And to go to that, you do jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y, Winter like the season. Hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. You know what to do with iTunes, review, etc. We're everywhere. I'm not going to read this line again. Remember, though, that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, or Apple Podcast Player, you'll be able to see the links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other visual content as we wrap it on. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you next week. Bye bye. Let's go indeed.
Are you recording?
Yeah, no.
Jeremy and I were just doing a happy face exercises.
Just getting those happy faces on.
Do some power poses.
Smile, baby.